Welcome to the Carl Landry Record Club, a music podcast from The Right's Ricky Sanchez. This is a bit of a cliffhanger for me because Mootloo, I'm Spike Eskin along with Mootloo. Hello, Mootloo.
Hey, how's it going, man?
So it's a cliffhanger for a number of reasons, because first of all, Mootloo played two big shows with Amos Lee in Boulder, Colorado, and he did his first flight, I think, since the pandemic began. So I want to ask him about that. But then right before we started recording, he hinted that there was more of a story. So let me do the intro thing and then we'll get to it. All right.
Yes.
Music podcast, a music appreciation podcast. We love music. We talk about two albums every week, and we love talking about them. We talk about other stuff, too. Talk about Amos or Mootloo's tour, which is going on right now. Some dates with Amos Lee, and then solo dates after that. Mootloosounds.com to get tickets to the tour, I think. Maybe that's, I don't know.
That's still happening.
Okay,
that's
all right.
Thing.
Okay. Intro music is from Marian Hill. It's called I Should Let You Know. To suggest an album for us to review, because every week we do one of our albums, meaning me or Mootloo, and one from a listener. Do it in the Apple Podcast reviews. Give us 5 stars as a rating, and in the review, give us the album that you want, and then grip it, rip it, and move on. Today's pod, 2 albums again. It's my week, so I just went... I've been trying to pick things that maybe you haven't heard or maybe you didn't know, or but I just went obvious this time with an album that I believe might be, I think, the best album ever, maybe, is Guns N' Roses' Appetite for Destruction from 1987. And the listener choice is the Arctic Monkeys, whatever people say that I am, that's what I'm not, from Apple user mbates91. Their review says... Great show for anyone who's a fan of music / getting recommendations on what to listen to. Smart and in-depth chats about music. The best thing is the opinions are honest and based on feelings. So thank you, mbates91.
Thank you. I like it.
So before I start asking you questions, do you have like a lead or do I just ask you questions?
Well, no, because the experience in Boulder was phenomenal, but concurrently to that, something was happening here.
Uh-oh.
Which I feel like I've navigated my way out of, but it was kind of crazy.
What?
Let me see how I can set this up. You know, sometimes you make lucky decisions and you don't realize were lucky decisions.
Yep.
In this case, it was leaving a day early.
Okay.
To go out to Colorado. But if you want to set it up, we can work backwards towards
okay.
it.
Okay. All right. Boy, that's sort of like, that's normally the story that people tell when they don't get on the plane. Do you know what I mean?
That's
like,
true. That's true.
So, so played 2 shows out in Boulder. The first thing I actually wanted to ask you about was traveling, because of all of your, if you don't mind talking about it, of all of your anxieties being on the plane next to people, yada, yada, yada. You were asking me stuff about that. I'm curious as to how that went for you. It was, I think I've flown 3 times maybe since the beginning of the pandemic, and I didn't like it any of the 3 times, though the 3rd time I was less anxious than the first. But how did that go?
It was exactly to a T the way you described it. I mean, you couldn't have been more on the money. But the fact that we had the conversation actually helped, like, give me some peace of mind, you know?
Okay.
Because, yes, people take every opportunity they can find to take their masks off.
Yeah.
It was a little bit unnerving. Now, on the way there, and as far as the Philly airport, was pretty chill both ways. It was the Denver airport.
Oh, yeah.
That was intense.
Yeah.
And I'll give you an example. The flight home, there's this couple sitting on the aisle across from me. Now, both times we lucked out, Southwest, Dilly and I didn't have anyone sitting next to us. So that was kind of a lucky break. But then the aisle across from us was this couple, and they had their daughter. They were the quintessential example of taking every opportunity to take the mask off. The mother, the wife, the woman, you know, I didn't get their names. I didn't really socialize with them, but she ate a salad, right? She ate a salad for 45 minutes.
Yeah, this
and
is
the
what
mask
I told
was,
you.
And the mask was off, and I was really frustrated by that. Then the father, the husband, he ate pretzels for like probably half hour, 45 minutes, mask all the way off. They let their daughter have her mask off the entire time, even though the flight attendant told them multiple times that she should put it on.
And you got to feel for the flight attendants, because what are they going to do? You know what I mean? It's not like they have a gun. It's not like, you know, like,
no.
What are you going to do? Yeah.
It's unnerving, because to me, it's like, here's the etiquette on the plane. Like, you have a snack, you pull the mask off, you take a bite, you put the mask back on.
Yeah.
You know, you don't take it off and have a nice maskless siesta and breathe your droplets all over the plane for the next half hour. So that was unnerving to me. But I felt okay because, you know, I'm vaccinated. I have my mask.
Yep.
What else are you going to do, you know? And I think the most stressful part for me was getting off in Denver.
Yeah.
And it was just so crowded in that airport. Yeah. I mean, like, you couldn't get distance from people. That was the moment where I felt some anxiety creeping in, like, shit. Like, that was the worst part of it. But you know what? It was okay, man. It can be done. It can be done. Yeah.
And this is how I feel about the mask stuff, is that, do I believe that, like, me, if everybody has the mask on, everybody at once, it has to help. It has to help.
No question.
It has to help if everyone's doing it. However, once you start allowing for any drink at all or any food at all, like, as soon as they're breathing out there, like, maybe that help is over. So I don't know how much it actually helps. But what I would say is, I don't know. Like, it has to help some. I don't know. But what I would say is that, like, I look at it sort of in an airport as the universal sign of, you're next to me. Your comfort is on me to a certain extent. Well, like, all of our comfort is on each other. Like, let's make... Do I want to sit there with a mask on for hours and hours and hours? I don't. But what I really don't want to do is have everyone around me thinking, like, wow, what an asshole. Or, like, so I just sort of think it's this universal sign for, we're in this together, especially in this situation. We're in this together. Let's all get through it together, and let's have us all feel good and get through it. And that's why it was so frustrating to me, is like, bro, you're right next to me. You don't even know me.
Yeah.
Like, you could do this little thing that would make me feel so much better.
Right.
You know?
And
yeah.
We were extremely lucky. No one sitting next to us both ways.
There you go. Oh,
and
wow.
On mostly full flights, like, somehow both times we had a few of those, whatever few free seats were left next to us. I do a thing. Okay, this is a thing, though. It's a little of a strategy Jillian and I have.
Okay,
she sits
you
on
fart?
The aisle. Well, if push comes to shove, I certainly would.
Okay.
I would let it rip in a second.
Yeah.
But, I mean, the thing is, when you fart on a plane, nobody knows.
No.
You can rip the loudest fart of all time. No one knows. No one cares.
Yep.
Maybe they get a waft of it, but it gets – the air filtration takes it up. So it does – you can fart 10 times right next to somebody on a plane,
and they
will never know.
It does show the air filtration thing is probably legitimate, because you're right. I've farted a million times on planes, and I don't think I've ever even smelled it. So,
how many farts on a plane per flight on average? How many farts do you rip? Let's
say
a longer flight, yeah.
Like an LA flight?
Let's say here to LA. Let's just give me a ballpark.
30.
30?
Yeah.
Good God. Oh,
yeah.
You really take that chance to just let it all out.
I mean, nobody seems to notice it, I guess.
They don't. So. They don't. It's amazing. There's no other situation in life where you can be sitting right next to someone and rip, and they'll just, you know, keep eating their pretzels or reading their magazine.
Yeah, yeah. So that's what I told Moot. If you didn't listen to the last episode, I told him that that's what was going to happen. Your anxiety was going to be because people would look for any excuse to take it off. And then seeing it makes you more anxious. You're just like, put it on.
Yeah.
And then, Colorado was the first place I went. I flew into Denver. And it's a weird mix of, like, incredibly liberal people and, like, freedom people or whatever in Colorado. You know what I mean? Like, it sort of reminds me of Portland a little bit, in that if you go away from the concentrated downtown, you're sort of like almost like PA you're like in the woods really quickly. It sort of
you got like the Texas attitude in Portland State.
Yeah.
You know, it's a different
So the next thing I was going to do is ask you about, like, the this is your first like big show that you've played, you know, at a big, what is the place, what's the place called and how many
people? It's the Chautauqua Auditorium. I think the outdoor thing I did with Amos in Delaware was maybe capacity wise bigger, but it felt very, this felt like, you know, that was like they had people, it was limited capacity. They had people in pods. It had to be, you know, still the limited capacity thing, even though it was outdoors. So yeah, this felt like the first big, you know, concert hall show.
Okay.
You know, or shows, I should say.
And foolish crowd,
full crowd.
How did the show feel? I mean,
awesome, yeah. Awesome. It was such a good feeling. Just musically, I don't know. I felt like both Amos and I were so dialed. And you know, there's those. We've done a lot of these acoustic shows together, acoustic tours together in Europe and here. So we have a nice rhythm. It's a very seamless kind of thing. Sound check is easy, but there was just this energy from the crowd. That felt so good that I think tends to happen every time I play in Colorado. That's the experience I've always had. Not even just Denver Boulder, but up in the ski towns, like, you know, I played like Breckenridge and Vail and Aspen. Like, people just love music there.
Yeah.
And, you know, I did my 40 minutes both nights. Amos did his 90. We closed it out with Arms of a Woman. It
together?
Just, yeah, yeah.
Awesome.
And singing that song. I mean, we talked about this, but you know, that's what we've been doing. That's the collaboration we've been doing on stage each show. Singing that song in this concert hall, especially both nights were phenomenal. Especially the first night, he was playing like real kind of rhythmic but quiet, and it was almost like we could have been doing an a cappella, you know. Mm-hmm. And there was just this magic. Now the venue is in one of these venues that's on the National Register of Historic Places, the Chautauqua Auditorium. It's over a century old. It's this massive barn that they just renovated into a concert hall. And it's one of those places where you really could go without the sound system, especially if you're doing an acoustic show like we were doing.
Really? Because
the natural acoustics in there, it's all wood, are just so warm. It's like, I tried it a couple times, sound check, just like stepping off the mic. I was even considering doing it during my set, but I stayed on the mic. But it was just, you know, it's a big cavernous place, but it probably only fits like 1,600 people. It's like one level with kind of three like sections of seats that go all the way back. And here's the big, well, the show experience was awesome, but here's a huge part of this. These two shows gave me a snapshot of how this can be done safely. Like, it showed me that, yes, even though we're still in this pandemic, if everyone is on board, the people at the venue, the artists, their team, the crowd themselves is on board to do this right, you can do a bigger show like this and you can be safe. I mean, they required vaccination or a negative test from everyone that came in. Everyone was required to wear masks. There were no meltdowns. It was organized. The people at the venue were on point. I kind of got a glimpse of how the line was going into the venue. It was very chill. No one had any problems or conflicts or confrontations or anger about masks or anything. And then on our end, everyone backstage masked the whole time. Aside from when Amos and I are on stage, we're all masked the whole time. We all took rapid fire tests before we went on stage. And that's kind of a nice feeling, you know, before soundcheck, you take the rapid fire test. Okay, I'm negative. I'm good. You know, and so it just showed me that there is absolutely the way to do this safely and make it enjoyable, have peace of mind. It felt like a confluence of a lot of things. Just seeing that sort of, you know, filled me with a sense of optimism that no matter how much longer we have to navigate this, we can do it. The experience of that venue, the shows, the crowd, it was pretty special. I'd say it's a special two nights.
Yeah, and nothing's going to be perfect, and you know, but like if you take enough effort and take enough steps to do what you can, then I think you can do the best that you can. And like the worst, if you're doing the best that you can, the worst case scenario of what could happen is very small. Like, I think that, you know, like I don't think that much can happen. I think Lollapalooza had 200,000 or 300,000 people, and I think that now who knows how many people actually had it afterwards.
Right.
But I think in the 2 weeks afterwards there were 200 or 300 people, and that's a, you know, and that's an out. Now they did also vaccination and negative tests to get in there.
That's huge. That is huge.
Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, not everything. And by the way, it's a credit to the venue. It's also a credit to the guy that you're touring with, who I'm sure yes. is, you know, who spent, I'm sure he'll tell the stories of it. And I was talking to him, like, at some point he's got to come on here
Absolutely.
When the new pod comes out. But I'm sure that he's doing it the safe way. That's what I would say. So the people yeah. that you're touring with, you got to pick the right people to tour with, too.
Yeah, and a quick little tangent. You planted the seed. When we had John Ross on, I think we learned a lesson, because we had him on a few months too early.
Yep.
And it was great to have him on, but it might have been more impactful if you'd had him on in April. And I think with Amos, we should do a deep dive into that new record and try to time it. So it's like, yep. you know, it, right as that record is jumping off. I think that'll be a great epic conversation. Of course, Tommy and Tony are going to have to drop.
Yeah, of course.
They might unravel the whole thing. I don't know. But
John Ross, the lead singer of Wild Pink, and we had him on very early in the pod, and it was like 2 months before the record came out. And God bless him for just saying yeah. okay, you know.
Yeah.
So yeah, I think two albums ago, Amos was on the Ricky the day his album came out, actually.
Oh yeah, I think I remember that. That was not the last record.
No, two records.
Was that Spirit? Spirit. I think I remember
Spirit.
That. Yeah. Yeah, so. I think that's what we should try for.
Yeah.
May not always line up that way, but yeah, this was I mean, see, the thing with he and I is that we're both hypochondriacs. We've always
yes.
been that way. We were the guys who would hear someone sneeze in a place and run away.
Yeah.
We're the guys who always had sanitizer.
Well, so, he's not a handshaker. He's a fist pounder.
But I, you know, we've already felt that way about things. Being on the road or even just home in Philly. Like, so it's actually good to tour with someone who has that same neuroses about this, because I know he's as worried about everything as I am. And I know he's going to take all the steps to make sure it's good, you know?
What am I missing? So you go there, you do the show, the show's good.
Right.
By the way, no meet and greet stuff, I assume?
No. Well, okay. you know, I mean, at the end of the night, not an official meet and greet, there'd be a couple people who I would wear my mask, and I was kind of like right outside the sort of the green room area, which was kind of just went out to this pavilion. And a handful of people, distance, also mostly wearing masks, would say a couple quick things, but it wasn't like an official meet and greet or anything
yeah.
like that. You know, you
cool.
can't really, I don't think you can really do that. But, so as this whole experience is happening, and this we're having such a good time out there, my building here in Philly got hit with a flood, like severe damage. And the reason I said it was a lucky decision to leave a day early
yeah.
was because if we had decided to leave the day before the show, I wouldn't have made the shows. We wouldn't have made the shows because people were stranded in this building for about a day and a half.
Really?
And I'll send you the picture. We're
is
right
your apartment okay? Are you? Like,
yeah, actually, I've been in a we've been in a hotel the last couple of nights, but I'm taping at the house now. Pretty much everything is back up and running. They had the power going pretty much all the way along.
Okay.
Then I think it was without water for a couple of days, but we weren't even here yet. Water came back. And then the next thing, the internet came back. So you know, we're using the internet here. And then the last thing was the HVAC, and it wasn't clear that they were thinking maybe it might take a few weeks to get this thing.
Oh my God!
Because they thought the cooling towers were damaged. I don't know if they got a temporary cooling tower, but all of a sudden today that's back. So we had a hotel room for one more night right nearby. We're gonna stay there and then back on track, which is a lot sooner than I thought. But it's crazy. Our friend sent us this video of basically imagine like an apartment building with a driveway, but a river is just going into it.
Oh no!
It went into the lobby. Somehow the front desk and the mail boxes were okay, but it destroyed the management office. It destroyed the package room. They have to like demolish that. There's just this outside in the garage and alongside with this like mud sludge out there that miraculously doesn't smell somehow. But it's kind of a strange thing when you walk in. It's like, and they have all these, you know, contractors out there doing the full cleanup, and you know, I think they have to use certain chemicals to like check the, you know, make sure there's no mold and check the moisture,
yeah.
and especially in the lobby, they got fans running, and it's just kind of a trip. But luckily, you know, a couple nights in a hotel, and we're here. But the crazy thing is, we just went out a day early because hey, it's Colorado, you know. But what if
you went out when you were supposed to? You wouldn't have gotten out.
I would have missed the
yeah.
shows. It's crazy. So sometimes you make decisions that are seem random or just like kind of what the hey, and they're the things that actually were the right decision, the perfect decision.
Yeah, when I bought the house that I'm on, in the listing, it specifically said in the listing, and this was, you know, a few months ago, it said not in a flood zone. And I'm like, that's like a weird thing to note. I guess it's good, but like whatever. So the storm comes through and I'm basically sitting in there and I'm alone. My wife is in Philly because we had a wedding on Thursday. Her brother got married Thursday night. So Wednesday I'm alone here with the dog and just hoping that the roof of the house doesn't blow off. Like really just thinking to myself like, and you know, I'm not making light of the situation. That I want to be clear, that's not what I'm doing. I'm just trying to paint the picture. And I'm like, oh my God, I just bought this house. The fucking roof's going to blow off. So everything was okay. The next morning, I looked out on the street. It looked okay, so I went to run. I went to the other side of the street. We live on like an oval. I went to the other side of the street, and the other side of the street was under like 2.5 feet of water. The whole side of the street. And the reason that my house says it's not in a flood zone is because the other side of the street, of my street, is a flood zone.
Wow.
So mine is not, and that is. And then when I tried to drive out on Thursday morning, everywhere I would turn, like I would turn right, and I'd be like, oh, car's like up to the roof in water. Oh, turn left. Wow. Like I didn't think I was going to get out of here. It was fucking wild.
Did you actually make it to the city?
I did. I made it to the city and I made it to the wedding. That's a whole other set of worries. Let me tell you that. The fucking wedding.
Oh, that I don't know that. I don't know that I could do that. That's different. That's a little different. You know?
Yeah. It was my brother-in-law. I didn't have a choice.
Of course, and, you got to go.
You know, there are some things where I'm just like, so I went into it like sort of anxious about the whole thing. But then you get there and you're like, you look around and you're like, well, if I'm getting COVID, I'm getting COVID. So at this point, so I might as well just like be here at least. I did not want to dance. I hate dancing anyway, but I was like, my wife said, hey, cut up and dance. I'm like, no, I'm not standing in the middle of
it. Did it feel like the dance floor was the riskiest situation?
Well, that's where everybody's like heavy breathing and standing next to each other. And again, you know this. We've been doing the pod for almost a year now. Like I'm not alarmist about any of this stuff, but if my option is to not stand in the middle of where everyone is dancing or stand in the middle of where everyone is dancing, I'm going to go with not. I'm going to like take my chances 10 feet away. So, you know, what are you going to do?
Yeah. I'm definitely more on the alarmist side. I would say yes. You're definitely a different part of the spectrum.
Yeah. I'm certainly not, denier or this isn't serious or anything like that. I just like the way that I handle anything is if the minute that I decide that I'm obsessed with something, there's no turning back. And like I've sort of made it an effort to like, that was why I went on the trip with my brother, like to force myself to not be that way because I didn't know if I would ever be able to get out again if I was like that. So everybody get vaccinated, wear your mask. I'm on board. I want to be clear. I'm on board.
And let me take one more second just to springboard off that. A little PSA because I feel we should do it because I see every artist doing this or almost every artist. Like if you're listening and you're on the fence, I know some people, they have ideological reasons, whatever. I'm not going to try to. There are people who have questions about it and are on the fence and try to weigh the pros and cons. And all I would say is, if you're on the fence and you're weighing the pros and cons, if you love music, put a big check mark in the pros side of things. Because the best, like, we've all been out of work for a year and a half. And the best chance we have to keep doing this and to make sure that these fall tours happen, a few things have already gotten canceled, you know, is that everyone, more and more people get vaxxed. And really, a lot of venues, you're not going to be able to get in. Like, some of the shows, all the West Coast, East Coast shows I have, are vax or negative test. Some of the venues are straight up vaccination. Philly, New York, San Francisco, you can only come in vaccinated. So if you love music, like put a big check in the pros column that maybe puts you over the top of why you would go ahead and
do it. Like, you know what? I'm not one to say that you shouldn't be like question and be concerned and be like, well, what is that? Where did it come from? Yada, yada, yada. But like, if you're gonna be the person that says that like life is about risks, You know, like, not everything's perfect. You get in your car, because that's what I used to say all the time. Like, you get in your car, you drive to work, you don't look at the stats of that every day, yada, yada, yada. If everything's not going to be perfect, then, like, if you want to find fault with the vaccine, you're going to find fault with it. There's certainly, like, there's certainly side effects that are possible, all that kind of shit. The truth be told, though, if you want more shit like that, and if you want the world to be closer to normal and people like you to be able to tour, and even selfishly, you to be able to go to a show, as you were just saying, then that's, you know, that honestly, just to be able to go to a show or to be able to go out to dinner, it's fucking worth it to me.
Like, absolutely.
That's, yeah.
So. And in closing, for the love of God, don't take any horse paste, okay?
Yes, no, don't take any horse paste.
No horse paste.
No that's, horse paste.
Don't question the vaccine and then go ahead and take horse paste.
Yeah, don't say this thing's not proven and take the other non-proven thing.
Right.
Now, if you want to get vaccinated and do the horse paste on top of it, I can't blame you. I mean, that's a... Okay. You want to take... You know, I can't. I guess I can't blame you. So we were gonna do. I was gonna do a couple of cities, but I'm gonna skip them, and we'll do them next time.
Right,
what's next for you on tour, and what are the dates? Because I don't know if this will be out by that time. So this will be out on the 14th. Do you have any shows before the 14th of September?
No, but right after that, next week. So a couple days right after that, right back out there with Amos. We're doing two nights in. New England, basically, first night in Hyannis out on the Cape, and then Cohasset, which is kind of on the Boston South Shore. So kind of
okay,
two
cool.
beach area shows. So those are the 16th and the 17th. So those should be fun.
Awesome. Well, as of right now, you can still go to see that show if you listen to the pod. So
absolutely.
So I will flip a coin to see which album we are doing first. Hang on. What do you want Guns N' Roses to be, heads or tails?
Heads, and man, am I excited to talk about this because it's been a long time coming. So heads.
And we got heads.
All right.
We got heads. So we'll do Guns N' Roses first. My selection is Guns N' Roses, Appetite for Destruction, 1987. Maybe there's some, you know, this album is now, 35 years old, as I mentioned to my wife when we were listening to it in the car. So there's probably people listening to this that weren't alive when the album came out, maybe don't know the context of it. So I'll briefly do the context because I don't think everyone needs a ton of, like, Guns N' Roses history. But Guns N' Roses for this album, there's Rebel.
Hey, Guns N' Roses. He loves Guns N' Roses. I mean, come on.
He does. He's a huge, huge Guns N' Roses fan. So Guns N' Roses for this album was Axl Rose / Izzy Stradlin, Duff McKagan, and Steven Adler. If you see Guns N' Roses now, the only three of those that are still in the band are Axl Rose / and Duff McKagan. Izzy Stradlin was in a band. This is like early to mid-80s, 84, 85. Izzy is in a band with Axl called Hollywood Rose. At the same time, there's a band called LA Guns, also an LA strip band. So the first show, so there's this guy, Tracy Guns, that is in LA Guns, and he's in the first iteration of Guns N' Roses. First iteration has Izzy Stradlin, Axl Rose, and Tracy Guns. LA Guns, who was also a good band, not as good as Guns N' Roses, but also a good band. So they do a show, their first show is called... I think was called something like Hollywood Rose and LA Guns present Guns N' Roses. So after the first show, Duff McKagan joins the band. They had a different bass player for that first show. After the show, Duff McKagan joins the band. Shockingly, Tracy Guns gets in a fight with Axl and leaves the band. Then that is when Slash joins the band. So the whole reason that it was called Guns N' Roses was because of Tracy Guns. Tracy Guns almost immediately not even in Guns N' Roses anymore, and Slash joins. And then the drummer, who was also an LA Guns member, leaves the band when Tracy Guns leaves the band, and that's when they got Steven Adler, who's really only there for Appetite for Destruction, I think is on a couple tracks of Use Your Illusion. So make a name for themselves in LA, get signed to Geffen, and put out an EP called Live Like a Suicide, which I actually had the vinyl of at one point, and I don't have it anymore. four songs on Live Like a Suicide, which all end up on GNR Lies, which is the second official Guns N' Roses LP release. Mama Can, all covers. Mama Can. Restless Life, Nice Boys, and Move to the City. At that point, they go to record their full length, and after going through a bunch of different producers, they hire Mike Klink, who had, at that point, I think only produced a couple of Triumph records, would go on to produce Motley Crue record, Megadeth, Whitesnake, Use Your Illusion 1 and 2. The budget for Appetite for Destruction was $370,000.
Woo! Those are the days, huh?
Yeah, right? So the amazing, or one thing that I didn't know until I was reading about it, and I had the tape. I did not have vinyl, but I had the tape. It is that it wasn't an A side and a B side. It was a G side and an R side. And the first six songs are the G side, and they're all like drinking and drugs and out to get me. And the R side is all sex and relationship songs, which is the second half of the record, which is like Think About You and My Michelle and, you know, Rocket Queen and all those. So the album comes out in 87, and like nothing happens. They can't get radio to bite on it. They can't get MTV to bite on it. Nothing.
Really?
Huh. Yeah. And eventually, Geffen convinces MTV to play it like three times at night. And it instantly, Welcome to the Jungle at that point.
The video.
I mean, like, what the fuck is Rebel's deal at this point?
Because he loves Guns N' Roses.
Loves this
You
album.
Said Welcome to the Jungle. He barked right on cue, man.
Yeah.
Cut him a break.
So MTV plays Welcome to the Jungle, immediately becomes this huge MTV hit, which I'm sure we've talked about this at different times. In my youth, you know, late 80s and early 90s, MTV is where I found out about new music. Actually, mid 80s to early 90s, that's where I found out. They broke a lot of bands on MTV. And the album itself did not eventually hit number one on Billboard, but not until a year after it came out, which is not what normally happens. To date, it has sold 18 million albums in the US, 30 million albums worldwide. I think this album is the best example that I can think of the sum being greater than the parts. And that is not to say that they're not all incredibly talented. They are. But when you look at what they've done separate from each other, it just doesn't, like, even come close to comparing. You know, Chinese Democracy is basically an Axl solo record. And while there are well-written songs on it, it does not have any, the album's got no soul. It's got no warmth. It's like, it just, it does not, it is missing Izzy and is missing Slash, right?
And I have a quick side note about that. Sorry to interrupt, but...
No, go ahead.
That was the one that he worked on compulsively and obsessively, right?
Yes, for like 20 years.
Because Bob Ludwig, the legendary Bob Ludwig, mastering engineer, mastered my label album, Live In It, and I remember him telling me that Axl had him remaster it 10 different times.
Yeah.
Like, well, over and over and over, to the point where it just, like, no one had any perspective on it.
He spent too long on it, and it was like, it's almost like drawing a picture that you keep adding a little more to perfect, and you fuck it up, so you just keep adding more and more to it to try to perfect it. And like that, it was never, he was left to his own devices, right? There were no other bandmates. He could fire whoever he wanted. He could, you know, there were so many different band members that ended up on Chinese Democracy. And again, if you go through it and just listen to the songs for what they are, there are some good songs on Chinese Democracy, but it sounds flat, like obviously because it was just produced too much, and it almost sounds like thin, oddly enough. So Axl does Chinese Democracy. Slash has a band called Snake Pit that had a few different singers, never quite measured up. Izzy Stradlin had the Juju Hounds, like fine, I guess. Duff has had a number of projects, but none of them are what they are when they are together. And I think that this album, of all of the albums that came out in the late 80s, this is the capsule, because it is the perfect mix of like songwriting and attitude and like griminess. And it like, when you hear this album, you almost feel like you're on the strip in Hollywood in the late 80s.
Yeah.
And like, it doesn't, like the album doesn't exist without any one of their, so I say the sum is greater than without Axl's like shriek and howling, like without his signature voice, this album is not what it is. Without Izzy's songwriting or rhythm playing, it isn't what it is. Without Slash's like very soulful, bluesy, like lead playing on this, it isn't what it is. Or even without Steven Adler, like just fucking playing loose and hard and fast and sloppy, like he plays the drum so hard on this, it doesn't add up. There are the obvious songs, like Welcome to the Jungle is just like fucking
monster.
You know, Sweet Child of Mine's a monster. Paradise City's a monster. The ones that I wanted to mention were just like, It's So Easy. Is like the chaos of the beginning of that song. Like it feels like a train rushing at you. And even like the way that Axl sings. And then Out to Get Me.
Oh yeah.
Is like the chaos of the end of that song. Like that song builds and builds and builds. You're crazy. Which is a song that there's an acoustic version of on Lies, which you would never guess that this song works as an acoustic version, but it does, and it proves it's so good. And like My Michelle sounds like a nightmare almost.
That song is dark, man.
Yeah.
It's just so intense.
What was that? The first lines, your daddy works in porno now that mommy's not around. She used to love her heroin, but now she's underground. Like, oh my.
Anytime going right to the heart of that thing, and it just there's nothing veiled on the lyrics in that song.
I mean, just talk. I mean, I guess I don't know what else to say other than like I don't think that there's a like a not awesome song on the album. Like I think that every song on the album is amazing, and I truly think it's probably the best album of all time. And it's my favorite album of all time, I think I would say.
And correct me if I'm wrong, this is the record that sort of sparked your passion for music, right? I remember you saying it kind of began with Guns N' Roses. For you, it begins with Guns N' Roses.
So, yeah, it begins like in 1987, like right around then, 87, 88, with these bands. And this one, seeing like Welcome to the Jungle on Guns on MTV, it was like it sparked this kind of music. I had Thriller before this, right, and all that kind of shit. But like, but this was the one that I think set out for me to be who I was as a teenager. Really, like it was this. You know, it was this album.
A life altering record, which we all have those. But yep. It's cool when you can look back and say this was the one.
Yeah. Yep. And even one other line I wanted to point out, because I didn't mention Mr. Brownstone, which is like...
Oh, yeah. I was surprised you didn't get into that one.
Well, I mean, it's every song. Every That's song. Why I don't.
We could do a song by song. We could have done a song by song, probably full episode about this.
The opening lines to this one, like with My Michelle, I get up around 7, get out of bed around 9. I don't worry about nothing because worried's a waste of my time. It's like, yes.
Oh, man. Just the lyric writing is so good on this record.
It's so good. And anyone, you know, I saw them at Lincoln Financial Field with, you know, Axl, Slash, and Duff. And, like, everyone was so, thought it was such a good show. And it just, it wasn't a bad show, but it wasn't Guns N' Roses. And I sent you, if you've never watched it, or if you're just learning about this album now, there's a concert that used to be on MTV all the time, which was Guns N' Roses Live at the Ritz.
Oof, man.
About 5 or 6 years ago, I hitchhiked here and ended up stuck out in the middle of this place. Climbed up out of the freeway. This little old black man comes up to me and my friend with our backpacks and about $10 between us. And he goes, "You know where you are? You in the jungle, baby! You know the gang!
And wow. like all you need to do is watch that and realize why the thing that you're watching, I'm not saying you shouldn't go see it at a stadium or wherever you see it. It's a good show, but you watch that and you're like, oh, that's not the fucking same thing at all. It's not the same thing.
You sent me that this morning and I watched it right before we came on. And, you know, as you watch that, you're like, this is the band. This is a band so locked in. Having a blast, like, because they came to hate each other, right?
So yes,
but they love playing together at this point, and you just feel, oh wow, this is the energy of this performance, and the crowd. This is a band on the cusp of massive superstardom.
Yeah,
you just see that at that, because I don't think they were quite there yet, right? They were on the ascension at that point.
Yeah, they were like oozing such confidence in that show, like a club show, you know what I mean? Like a small club show, but they just fucking, the way that you said it is right. They're so locked in during that show and you can see it and they're all at their best and they're all probably fucking drunk and high, but they're all so locked in. And I wouldn't say they all came to hate Axl. Like, the Axl was the problem.
They were
like,
cool with each other, but it was Axl versus the band, basically.
Yeah, I think the Adler thing went off the rails first because he had a real serious drug and alcohol problem. I've interviewed him a couple of times, a sweet guy. Really? Troubled, but sweet guy. But yeah, I think Axl was the creative center of the band, but also the most difficult to get along with.
Yeah, it's, man, where to start with this? We could have done a separate thing just on that concert, but I'll go through a few things. I wrote so many things down as I was listening to this. Welcome to the Jungle. We talked about some records, they take their time to reveal themselves to you, but then there's this other thing where, boom, that first song, that lead track on that debut album announces the arrival of this band. And yeah. I don't know that any song has ever done that better than Welcome to the Jungle. And, you know, like a song like that, it's so tightly constructed. That's what I love. Like, the spirit of it sounds raw and drunk and sloppy, but I don't... Musically, it's not that. Arrangement-wise, it's not that. It's very tightly constructed.
Yeah.
I mean, first and foremost, Axl Rose is a vocalist like no other. Now, when I listen to him, I can hear the notes of Brian Johnson, you know, from AC. I can hear even Robert Plant, but it's a perfect example of, and I would say this about Guns N' Roses in general, an artist that... It's never imitation, it's emulation, taking a few touchstones and making something that's distinctly you. And Guns N' Roses had that from day one. Then we get to Slash's playing. You kind of touched on this. The rock and roll music that I love the most, and we got to this actually on Cinderella, which I never would have expected. The rock and roll music that I love the most, no matter what the approach, is the rock and roll music that you can, where you can hear the blues in it.
Yep.
And when I listen to Slash, I hear the blues in the way he plays. And he's got all the technical dexterity, but he can just play three notes and just, you know, hit you in that emotional spot, you know, where he doesn't need to play a lot. He can, but he's so dynamic and tasteful that I just think, you're right, all the components of this band, I think on like a bigger picture, what really makes them special is, and you even see this in the concert that you sent me, that's at the Ritz, right? 88 at the Ritz, is that... They have this incredible combination of like toughness and swagger, but then it's always coupled with this undeniable melodic sense, but these like very, very heartfelt kind of moments. Like Sweet Child of Mine is one of the greatest songs ever in my book.
Yeah.
Yep. That's a song you could arrange 15 different ways and it would be undeniable in every context. And it's not even just the melody and the lyric and the sentiment and the hook, it's the guitar line. The guitar line is the thing that brings you into that song, and that's an amazing hook. Like the whole song is just hooks. And
by the way, not a compact song, like a 5-minute song, like just a masterfully written song, though.
Yeah, and there's not a note out of place. Every note is intentional, even in those drawn-out sections, you know?
You mentioned Slash not having to play a lot of notes. Now, he can, but these are two songs that are not on this album, but when you listen to the solos in both November Rain and Estranged... Like, to me, they're great examples of Slash really, like, playing with the song and not playing faster than the song and, like, playing meaningful notes. And his tone is obviously perfect. But those two solos, I think, always stuck out to me from him.
Yeah. I mean, I got into them more at the Use Your Illusion records and eventually came back to this one. But, I mean, man, I feel like this is a band that we could go... You could go so many different directions about the impact they had. One thing I would say that's... I don't know if this is accurate to say. Maybe you could tell me whether it is or not. They seem like they were of that hair band era. But, like, I never thought of them as, like, a hair band. You know what I mean? They have the kind of look. I mean, they were at the same time. But if they were... And I think they might have toured with some of those bands, right? Like, the Poison and Motley Crue. But I never attached them to that scene because... Somehow, I think for even fans, people who aren't like hard rock or metal fans, whatever, they transcended that very quickly.
Well, so the first arena tour they did was opening up for Aerosmith, which I think is appropriate, you know?
Yeah.
And there was a whole thing, you should Google it at some point, there was a whole thing with like Axl Rose challenging Vince Neil from Motley Crue to a fight, like over and over and over again, yeah. It was hairband era, but the only time that you ever see them... looking like that at all is Axl with his hair teased up in the Welcome to the Jungle video. Because everything after that was always, you know, speaking of Aerosmith, it was always like bandanas and like there were leather pants, but a lot of rock dudes wore leather pants that weren't hair bands. So they were part of that time. And I think they were grouped in with some of those bands, but I don't think they ever toured with Poison. And I'm just trying to
Motley Crue? Were they going to tour with Motley? No.
Maybe. And when I saw them for Use Your Illusion, Soundgarden opened up for them, actually, at Wells Fargo Center. Oh, so
that'd be a hell of a show, man.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I only saw like three songs of Guns N' Roses because that was the era when Axl didn't like would only go on when he felt like it. So I don't think they went on till 11 or 11:30, and I was 15 or something. So our ride was there. So I saw three songs of Guns N' Roses and then left.
That's a bummer, man.
Yeah, not great. Not a great memory. Not great. I like you said, I'm sure we'll come back to this at some point. If you have not listened to this album or if you just know the songs from the radio or something like that, it is really worth, I mean, I don't know how long it is. It can't be more than 50 minutes or something. It is really worth a throw the headphones on and go beginning to end because it is... I mean, there's not a miss on the album, right?
No,
I mean,
no. Yeah. And then, look, I just discovered this today because he told me about it. Then go watch the Live at the Ritz concert. That's the perfect companion piece to this record because a lot of these songs are in that show. So you see them in this live context in a club. Man, bands like this are meant to play in clubs. I mean, you can put them in the arena. You can put them in the stadium. It's never going to match the visceral upfront energy of a club.
Oh man, that video is so good.
It is.
It's my favorite concert video of all time. Like nothing is even close. And one other thing, you mentioned like them playing tight, even though like of what the perception is. Man, if Paradise City isn't the best combination of playing loose and playing tight at the same time. Like for 6.5 minutes, just like, man, what a fucking song that is.
That's a great point. That's such a great point because the vibe of the song, the energy of the song feels loose.
Yep.
It's like, it's like, you know, it's just kind of there, but they are all locked in. So if you can all lock in, it's kind of like the thing we talk about with R&B. Like if everyone in the band and like the D'Angelo record, the Sly and the Family Stone, if everyone is playing just behind the beat, you know, it's locked in and it just grooves so hard. If there's one guy that's out of sync, it falls apart.
Yeah.
And I think you could say the same about Paradise City. Like, the feel of it is loose, but because they're all so dialed in, it's not, I don't think it's sloppy, really. It's not.
Mm-mm. I don't think so. Yeah. 100 Mootloos from me, that album. My first ever 100 Mootloo album.
I'll take your 100 and I'll go 1,000 Mootloos.
Oh, showing me up once again. You survive your two shows, and you're throwing it right in my face.
Yeah, I'm just kind of going for the gusto.
Yeah. All right. The listener album, Arctic Monkeys, Whatever People Say I Am, That's What I'm Not. Thank you to MBates91 for the suggestion. You know nothing. Yeah, but I still take you home. Yeah, but I still take you home. So what do you know? Say you don't know nothing. Well, fancy seeing you in here. You're all tarted up, and you don't look the same. Yes, all right, indeed. What do we got?
Great suggestion. Now, Arctic Monkeys, not a band I ever did really a deep dive in, but I think it was impossible to not know who they are.
Yeah.
Going back to the mid-2000s. Really cool to actually listen to this record and kind of get into it. Give a little backdrop. The band is Alex Turner on lead vocals, guitar, keyboards. Jamie Cook on guitar, keyboards, and backing vocals. Matt Helders on drums and backing vocals. Now, the original bass player was Andy Nicholson. But he left in 2006, and since then it's been Nick O'Malley, and that's basically been the group all the way through. Kind of a serendipitous way this group emerged. Both Alex Turner and Jamie Cook started pursuing their music careers after receiving guitars on Christmas in 2001 when they were still in high school in Sheffield, England. So they both got guitars as Christmas presents and said, let's start a band, you know? So and they did it.
And then they went and got famous. Wow.
Yeah, I mean, it really kind of is like that.
Yeah.
Within a couple of years, they teamed up with their high school classmates, Matt Helders and Andy Nicholson. So this was a high school band. They started making demos. They started putting the tracks online. And it just exploded. This was one of the early bands, I think, but this is like mid-2000s. They were one of the first bands to really like harness this incredible marketing power of the internet. And I think, you know, now it seems commonplace, but I think that was part of what made them stand out. They were these kids who put these, they had no deal, nothing. They just put these tracks online and it exploded. You know, and before too long, they had every major label interested in them. But at that point, they already had an international audience, you know, a little more underground at that point. But it's interesting because despite all the label interest, they had a very specific idea of who they wanted to sign with, the type of label. They signed with Domino Records, which is like an India subsidiary label. They didn't go with one of the big labels. And I think part of that decision was some of the other acts that were on the label kind of gave them a certain cred. And one of the groups that was on the label is a band that I did spend a lot of time with that I'll probably pick at some point, Franz Ferdinand.
And I was going to mention them.
Yeah, I mean, there's a connection between these bands. I mean, stylistically, vibe-wise. So they signed a Domino. Now they start releasing tracks on an official level. I Bet You Look Good on the Dance Floor, When the Sun Goes Down, Come Out. Release's singles immediately hit number one in the UK, both tracks. Then, you know, maybe even somewhat unexpectedly for the band itself, Whatever People Say I Am, That's What I'm Not, that record hits and, like, is just seismic in the UK. It sells 363,735 copies in the first week. And, you know, very significant. I mean, probably not on the scale of the UK and maybe parts of Europe, but very significant success here in the US as well. And in a short time, they went from being these sort of viral underground darlings to kind of being like a mainstream group, but still maintaining that sound. NME ultimately called this one of the top five British albums ever released. Now, in the years since then, they've released five more records. Favorite Worst Nightmare in 2007, Humbug in 2009, Suck It and See, great album title, 2011, AM 2013, and Tranquility Base Hotel and Casino just a few years back, 2018. I think they're a band that I haven't tracked them closely, but I do see them as a band that doesn't just rest on their laurels. They have been adventurous in trying to expand their sound and mixing up with different collaborators, like on Humbug. They worked with Josh Homme from the Queens of the Stone Age. The Lax record they did almost went into this like more loungy kind of direction, and the title says it, Tranquility Base Hotel and Casino, kind of. The title gives it away. You know, they have become, whether you want to say they're one of the seminal bands of the last few decades, many people consider them one of the most significant British bands of all time. And listen to this record, you understand it. Like, I wouldn't say I love every song, but there's something infectious about this album when you really put it on, especially when you pop it on the headphones. The energy in this thing is just, you know, it's like, it really is infectious. And I'll give a couple highlights that I'm curious to hear your takes, but I Bet You Look Good on the Dance Floor. Or actually, no, I should start with the lead track, The View from the Afternoon. Anticipation has a habit to set you up for disappointment in evening entertainment. But tonight I'll be so. When I listen to that song, you hear like the punk rock energy, but there's like a little more like polish to it. You know, it's not. It's raw, but there's a little more of a sheen to the songs. And I would say, and one thing that Alex Turner does that I know you love is he sings in his natural English accent.
I love singing in accents. I do. I hate when they go away. Every time I listen to Def Leppard, I'm like, I love this band, but they'd be so much better if I could hear his accent.
Right, right. And there is something just very engaging about that. You know, I Bet You Look on the Dance Floor. Well, really kind of a defining song. Kind of have these like driving, kind of jagged guitars and drums. And then on this one, Alex Turner kind of has like the sort of semi-spoken vocal style, which I think is a, you know, staple of that kind of punk attitude. It's like you're not necessarily singing notes, you're kind of speaking the notes, you know?
Yep.
Songs like Dancing Shoes, when I hear those, I really hear a connection with Franz Ferdinand. Just like these high energy songs with very swift rhythm changes. The only reason that you came is to what you're scared for. You know, that's kind of the appeal of Franz Ferdinand, too. Always this great attack of the guitars. And another thing that both those bands do that actually, in a different way, GNR does is melodic hooks on the guitar. I mean, there are guitar melodies all over this record. You know, sometimes hookier than the actual vocal hooks. And then just one last tune. It's nice to see them as the record goes on, change it up a little bit about midway through. They have the song Riot Van. Because they won't find us if you do. Oh, those silly boys in blue. Well, they won't catch me and you. A little more of an understated approach. Kind of shows their range beyond like the frenetic energy of a lot of the other songs. And he kind of tells a story about how he and his friends are apprehended by the police. Kind of a storytelling kind of thing. You know, I think it's a really great record. Again, I wouldn't say I loved every song, but I did feel hooked in listening top to bottom, and it goes by quick. I think it's like 13 songs, 40 minutes, something like that. And you know, it's listening to this makes me want to check out some of the other records, go a little deeper into it.
It when he sings in that accent, it almost sounds like bratty. Like,
yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Like, yeah. there's a certain like attitude that I think Oasis and Blur have, who also sing with accents. That there's just sort of like bratty is like the best word I can put it. Like when I was listening to it, it took me a few listens to be quite honest, and I'll explain why. But on the third listen, I think it was earlier today when I was walking my dog, it really clicked. It's like a mixture between The Hives, Franz Ferdinand, and the Beatles almost. And like, you know, and because that punk energy is from is where it reminds me of The Hives. And when they really nail the hooks, there is like a good poppy part of it when they're doing that. That's the Beatles. And then the thing that I had to get over is I don't really like Franz Ferdinand.
Oh.
And but like when they're playing the guitar like that, like,
yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Like,
oh, yeah.
It's not my thing, but when they go into the full, like, playing and, like, the gang vocals of, like, I bet you look good on the dance floor, all you can do is think about if you were at a show and that chorus came on, that show, that the floor would be nuts, right? Like the crowd would go crazy. And I thought the same thing for Perhaps Vampires is a bit strong. I think that's what the name of the song is. And though you pretend to stand by us, I know you're certain we'll fail. I've seen your eyes as they fix on me, full of confusion. Your snarl is just so condescending. But like that one too, like when these songs get in their groove, and a lot of times it's the pre-chorus and the chorus and you lose that guitar is when I really, really like it. And then there's another song called A Certain Romance that felt the most Beatles and like Brit poppy to me. Because the minds are made up, of course it's all okay. That I really enjoyed. I think it makes me want to see them live. I think that was my big takeaway from it, is that I thought seeing them live would be a lot of fun and probably make you a much bigger fan than you would be, because I bet they're awesome.
Yeah, and they're one of those groups, we've discussed other bands like this, like when you hear the record, you kind of get a glimpse of what the live show is probably like, because there's that energy that comes through just in the recording. And I really admire bands that can do that, because the studio is such a sterile environment. It's not always easy to create that. So when a band can just come in and they're able to recreate that in the studio to the point where you say, oh man, I get a vibe of what the live show will be, that's pretty special. And you know, to think these guys, they were really young when they started, when they made this record. You know, it's pretty incredible the run they've had.
Well, you're talking about being able to make the record sound like that. To jump back to Appetite, it's funny, Steven Adler said he finished the drums in like less than a week for the album, but the album took such a long time because Axl was so like manic about what the vocals had to be like, and he would redo things over and over and over and over again. And to make an album sound that like reckless, but to be done with that much precision, it can't be easy, right?
That's the magic combination, because you talked about Chinese Democracy and he took it too far.
Yeah.
He took the feeling out of it.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, but if you can walk that line of still like harnessing that intense, almost spontaneous kind of energy, but then pull the studio craft into it. That's like a what was that called? That's like a seesaw musically. You know, if you go too heavy on one, the other goes up. If you go too heavy on the other, and it's not easy, because the studio is just it can be boring sometimes. There's a lot of sitting around when you know engineers cleaning up this and that. So it's kind of like making a movie. You know, people, actors talk about how they're just sitting around for hours and hours. I mean, that can happen in the studio too.
You hate waiting around while the producer's auto-tuning you, right?
Yeah, exactly. Or I just don't like how he's auto-tuning me. You know, he's just not putting it on the right words. Yeah, man. You know.
The other thing I was going to say about this album is that it does remind me of a place and time, in that 06, 07 was when I lived in Chicago and worked for an alternative station, and like all of these bands in this time like are a certain point in my life that I remember, like where I was, and I remember hearing, and they all, like, even the stuff I don't like from this era, I like a little bit because of what it reminds me of. But that's a very important thing for the albums that I like the most, is I remember where I was or how old I was or what was going on in my life when I heard them. And 06, 07, it was such a short time that I was there that all of that music sticks out in a pretty specific way.
So you were only in Chicago for those 2 years?
Yeah.
So YSP to, what was the name of the station again in Chicago?
YSP to Q101.
Right. For just 2 years, and then back to YSP.
Then back to YSP, yeah.
Oh. Yeah, right. I think almost every record I pick has some kind of, there's a moment, like I can kind of remember the time frame or how much I listened to it, or even sometimes, like I remember we were talking about this Depeche Mode, I remember having that cassette in my car and just driving around. There's like these like tactile experiences you put with it, and that's really the incredible part of music, is that it reconnects you to your memories and to moments in a way that I don't think anything else can. That's really the intangible magic of it.
Yeah. This is Grip It, Rip It, and Mootloo for me.
Grip It, Rip It. I'm going 10 Mootloos.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I liked it just enough. I could have gripped it, ripped it, and Mootlooed, you know?
Yeah.
I like to, you know, sometimes grip it, rip it, and Mootloo, but I'm going to keep it real and go 10 Mootloos.
All right. Well, we will be back next week with another pod, 2 records. Remember to submit yours in the Apple Podcast reviews or at CarlLandryRecordClub.com, even if you don't use Apple, as well on CarlLandryRecordClub.com. We have a whole list of all of the albums we've reviewed, and I updated that just, I think, last week. So we're almost totally caught up. That's all we got. We'll talk to you next week.
Stay free, my goose.